This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between, and they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal.
Hey, this is reporter Laura Starcheski. Reveal is listener-supported. To become a contributing member, text the word REVEAL to 474747. While they last, we're offering a Reveal face mask with the word FACTS embroidered on it. Again, to get this special thank you gift, just text REVEAL to 474747. Standard data rates apply.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. This is Chapter 5 of American Rehab, Reagan with the Snap. When we left off in the summer of 1978, CenterCorp founder Luke Austin had been ousted after he siphoned off most of the organization's money to support a life of luxury for himself. CenterCorp still had two facilities, its original headquarters in Colorado and its newer operation in Houston, Texas. But the organization was broke, and the 75 or so people living in Houston were struggling. Some had been there for years. Some were new, just starting to find a way out of addiction. And now, all of them were resorting to a diet of cornmeal mush and green Jell-O just to survive. But as Laura Starcheski of our American Rehab team tells us, things are about to get a lot more corporate at CenterCorp, with a little help from friends in high places.
With Luke Austin out, Ken Barron was helping run the Houston facility. He'd been at CenterCorp for 6 years, and now he was trying to come up with a way to save the organization.
We didn't have a business plan. I mean, I'm telling you, I didn't know what I was doing.
After Luke Austin was caught spending CenterCorp's money on himself, after the brawl where he tried retaking control of the organization with tear gas and baseball bats, CenterCorp gained a reputation. Not a good one. Donors were balking at giving money, prominent board members left, and Ken took it upon himself to give the program some legitimacy, something that had been tough in the best of times.
We had critics all the time, you know, and I'd go, look, it's working for me. It's working for other people. You know, you can criticize all you want, but none of the other programs are doing much better either.
Those other programs were few and far between. In Texas in the late 70s, even with all the Synanon-inspired rehabs, there still just weren't that many options for people seeking drug treatment. And to make Ken's job even tougher, for all the years he'd been at CenterCorp, he'd never really had control of the money.
I never carried money in CenterCorp, ever. I don't think I had $10 in my pocket at any one time in, you know, 8 or 9 years. Nothing. Nothing.
But what Ken did have was a fundraising pitch. From the beginning, CenterCorp participants were expected to pound the pavement and scrounge up donations. So he stuck to it, explaining the program to anyone who could help.
We got a therapeutic community, a program where people lived. We supported ourselves. We got donated food, donated clothing, donated cars. None of us got a salary, and that everybody has a job.
Those jobs had been fairly small time in the Luke Austin years. Landscaping gigs, the trucking business with one truck, the single CenterCorp gas station. Now it was time to think bigger. Senecor started getting more contracts with outside businesses, sending groups of workers out to do construction, to work at a door factory. They sent 20 people at a time to a company that manufactured giant roof trusses for building homes. Ken also arranged a contract with the Houston Astrodome. Crews of Senecor participants worked as landscapers. They would swarm the field and work around the clock when it needed to be turned over from baseball to football. And in 1980, Ken set up one more big contract.
Houston has the Oilers, the greatest football team. We take the ball from goal to goal like no one's ever seen. We're in the air, we're on the ground, always in control. And when you say the Oilers, you're talking Super Bowl, 'cause we're the Houston Oilers.
Houston Oilers number one. Yes, we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one.
You just can't help singing along with that Oilers song. Anyway, the Houston Oilers quarterback was Dan Pastorini. He'd been the team's first pick in the 1971 draft. A total star.
Dan Pastorini bullseyed 26 times for 354 yards on the afternoon and almost finessed Houston back to victory.
Picture a strong jaw and a dirty blonde surfer shag, and that's Pastorini. He dated Farrah Fawcett. He posed for Playgirl. Pastorini had what one newspaper called a freakishly strong arm. But he got hurt a lot.
And Pastorini is down. We watched Pastorini being carried out of this stadium earlier in the year on a stretcher. Dan is up now, but he really gets leveled.
After one of these injuries in 1978, three broken ribs, Pastorini was in Houston Methodist Hospital lying there in bed when two men walked in who he'd never seen before. Pastorini recounted this in an interview later with ABC News in Houston. One of these mysterious men was wearing a trench coat.
He came by the room carrying a brown paper sack and a friend of his with a baseball bat, and I thought they were going to pummel me to death and take me out of there.
But the man in the trench coat was an inventor named Byron Donzus. Out of the paper sack came Byron's latest invention.
So he just kind of nonchalantly takes this thing out and holds it over his ribs, and his buddy whacks him about three times, and I said, I'd like to have one of those.
Byron called his invention a flak jacket. It was designed just for football players.
2 days later, he shows up at practice. And he's got the prototype, which was made from a Navy SEAL life vest. And that worked. I mean, it was hot, but it was very protective.
In Pastorini's next game, he faced off against 300-pound defensive linemen. Under his uniform, the flak jacket hugged his cracked ribs tight. NFL Films called that game one of the 10 gutsiest performances in football. And the customized pads players wear today are still based on that original flak jacket.
Takes the ribs, their sternum, and they still have full motion. Now, quarterback would just as soon go without his jock as he would his flak jacket.
Pastorini and Byron Donzus earned a footnote in NFL history. But there's one big detail left out of that footnote. Senecor. When Byron Donzus was starting out, he had a prototype and a patent, but that's all. Byron was more of an inventor than a businessman. That's where Senecor comes in. Ken Barron made a pitch that Senecor had what he didn't. Workers.
Why don't we start making that stuff here? We can make it for you. Because it was all custom made, and he was making it like in his basement.
When Ken set up the contract with Byron, he cleared the entire 10th floor of Senecor's Houston Hotel and created a makeshift flak jacket factory.
Look, I didn't go for any codes. I didn't go to the city. I didn't ask for permission. We just set up this kind of manufacturing system. You know, we've got ovens. We're melting plastic. We're doing all kinds of crazy stuff.
The folks you see assembling the Donzus gear are participating in a Houston drug rehabilitation program called the Senecor Foundation, a group of people Byron is proud to be associated with.
We found this old news footage, which looks and sounds like it was recorded on a jumpy VCR tape. It's from a TV show called PM Magazine, broadcast in Beaumont, Texas in 1981. You can see the Centocor workers standing at workbenches, peering through big 1980s glasses, cutting plastic into shapes using cardboard templates labeled large rib and sternum plate. Byron explained the program.
Some 40 of them work with us in manufacturing by hand, sewing, molding, forming, cutting, everything by hand, and watching over it to make sure the quality is there.
Centocor started by supplying the Houston Oilers. From there, they ended up making flak jackets and other pads for all 28 teams in the NFL and 800 college teams.
Making football equipment was perfect. We manufactured the stuff, we received it, we shipped it out of there, so people learned shipping, receiving, and then guys would do sales. But it was a hoot of a job to do sales, and I did a lot of sales. I went to Hawaii twice to sell to the University of Hawaii.
Sometimes these lucky Centocor salespeople even got sideline passes to games. These brothers and sisters of Centocor had gone from living in a rundown hotel wearing donated jeans and eating cornmeal mush to wearing donated suits and jet-setting around the country. By 1983, Centocor was making millions of dollars a year. It was pulling in big donations from corporations like Shell and Boeing. Ken had taken over as president, and the leadership started getting salaries for the first time. Centocor was still not paying any wages to its participants, the workers, by the way. This was the moment when someone else got interested in what was going on at Centocor. Someone who would send its star rising even higher. One day, Ken's phone rang, and the voice on the other end said he was calling from the White House.
So I said, no, you're not calling from the White House. He said, yeah. He said, I'll give you my number, you can call me back. So 202-456-1414, I got White House. Can I speak to Mike Castine?
Mike Castine worked for President Ronald Reagan. He was the deputy director of something called the Office of Private Sector Initiatives.
Hold on, put him right through. Oh, jeez, what are you calling about? And so he explains to me, we're looking for a place for the president to visit. Could we come by and visit? I said, sure, you can come by and visit. I said, crazy, but come by.
Reagan was looking for places to speak, to show America what his federal drug policy was all about, which is how, in 1983, Reagan came to visit Centocor's old hotel in downtown Houston. In the photos from that day, you can see a banner that reads Centocor Enterprises and a young woman wearing a Centocor t-shirt in front of a sewing machine and a stack of flak jackets. Ken Barron got to introduce the president.
I appreciate him being here because we've worked so very, very hard for 15 years to get the recognition that we feel Centocor deserves, and this man has recognized that. Ladies and gentlemen, members of the press and distinguished guests, President of the United States.
Thank you all very much for a very heartwarming welcome. I'm very proud and happy to be here. And you know, I've seen some of the products and the things that you're doing here, and I might just buy some of that football equipment that I saw and use it with the Congress. So long as you don't sell them any.
Ken even helped the president test the flak jacket himself, reenacting that product demo from Dan Pastorini's hospital room.
We had to put a rib protector on one of the guys, and I was holding the baseball bat. I mean, the Secret Service was nervous about that. But then I handed it to the president. And I showed the president how to hit the guy in the ribs with a baseball bat, and then he took a swipe at the guy.
But this spectacle wasn't really about the football equipment. It was about pushing Reagan's economic policy, known as Reaganomics. He was slashing taxes and social services, shrinking the government. Centocor was the perfect example to show that the federal government didn't need to be involved in treating drug addiction at all.
This center is self-sufficient, just like all of you will soon be. Centocor receives no federal money, and so no federal strings come attached.
Well, it wasn't quite self-sufficient. Centocor actually had received government money. The Colorado facility had gotten almost $300,000 from the federal government. One early resident told me they'd eaten government cheese in Houston for years. Never mind all that. Senecor's approach spoke to Reagan.
I was glancing through your Senecor booklet, and I liked the very first sentence I read. In all the years that Senecor has been in business, rehabilitating lives, we have found that nothing works as well as work itself. And work is therapy. You feel better about yourself when you have something productive to do.
It also didn't seem to matter that Senecor's years-long work therapy program didn't work for most people. Beyond a core group of devotees like Ken, most people still left Senecor just a few months after they arrived. Those people who left, who didn't make it through the program, I couldn't find anyone like that still around to talk. But the believers believed. All the people I could find who were at Senecor in the early days, they loved it. Despite Luke Austin's abuse, despite the other failings, they stayed. And some even told me that Senecor saved their lives. Ken Barron still swears by what he learned there. And he knows the stakes are life and death. About 10 years ago, his daughter died of an opioid overdose. Knowing those are the stakes, life and death, when people come to Ken for help, he still tells them about Senecor. He even sent his own son there.
We've got somebody there who's doing very well. We've had people that haven't done very well.
I had told Ken the reason we're reporting on Senecor now is because it's participants' work, but it doesn't pay them. Ken says he knows the program doesn't help everyone, but that failing is not because of the unpaid work.
Nothing has to do with the jobs that I've heard. The only criticism that comes from that is journalists. I'm not knocking you at all, Laura, or people that have left the program. Oh, they made me work so hard. Well, what else would you be doing? What else would you be doing with your life if you're not working every day, learning a trade, or helping other people live? I mean, it's what would you rather be doing? Sitting in the therapy session all day long and talking to your navel or what? I mean, I don't get what people think life is about. Like I said, I didn't think I'd ever be able to live life again. And yet the example, the things that I did prepared me to live life. I mean, I've had great, I guess people would call it great success. I've had a great life after Senecor.
In his great life after Senecor, Ken went to work at the White House. After Reagan was reelected, he was recruited to work for Nancy Reagan's anti-drug campaign. Ken got his own office in the East Wing. He stopped wearing donated suits. He helped spread the gospel of just say no. He'd made it. And Senecor was about to get an even bigger boost from the Reagan administration.
To keep the program growing and the money flowing, Senecor needed people, workers, and the war on drugs would supply them.
If you don't take advantage of this, you're never going to see sunshine again for the rest of your life.
The prison to rehab pipeline. That's coming up after the break.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. When we left off, Centocor was doing great. They were making football equipment for the NFL, and the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, had praised their motto, work as a treatment for drug addiction. But things were about to get even better for Centocor because of that same president. Reveal's Shoshana Walter picks up the story from here.
To understand Reagan's impact on Centocor, first we have to go back to the drug crisis of the 1980s.
See this cute little vial here? It's crack, rock cocaine, the most addictive form.
Crack cocaine. There were tons of PSAs back then. They starred big deal celebrities like Clint Eastwood, warning about this growing threat.
You think it's the glamour drug of the 80s? Well, that's the point of this friendly little reminder. It can kill you. And if you've got to die for something, this sure as hell ain't it.
Fear about drugs was spreading across the United States. Imploring kids to stay off drugs had become First Lady Nancy Reagan's signature issue.
What should you do when someone offers you drugs? What will you do when someone offers you drugs?
Just say no!
I can't hear you. Louder.
Just say no!
That's wonderful.
While Nancy Reagan was telling the nation to just say no, her husband had an entirely different approach.
Smokable cocaine, otherwise known as crack. It is an explosively destructive and often lethal substance which is crushing its users. It is an uncontrolled fire.
Reagan wanted to completely eradicate crack, obliterate it. This was a war, so prevention campaigns like Just Say No weren't Reagan's top funding priority. Neither was treatment. He poured money into law enforcement. By 1986, roughly 80% of the federal drug budget was dedicated to policing and prosecuting people.
The American people want their government to get tough and to go on the offensive. And that's exactly what we intend, with more ferocity than ever before.
Reagan teamed up with Democrats who had control of the House to pass the bipartisan Anti-Drug Abuse Act. Prominent black politicians backed the law. They were eager to show their constituents that they had a response to how hard crack was hitting their neighborhoods. Almost no one realized at the time that one tiny clause in this complex new law would end up paving the way for thousands of black and brown people to end up in prison. The new law created a two-tier system of justice. It said that 5 grams of crack cocaine would get you the same sentence as 500 grams of powder cocaine, meaning that somebody with just a little more than a sugar packet's worth of crack would get sent away for the same amount of time as somebody with about a pound of powder cocaine. In the years after the law was signed, the people busted for crack were overwhelmingly black, and they got much harsher sentences than the mostly white people busted for powder cocaine. In the late 80s, President George H.W. Bush piled on with another harsh anti-drug law, pouring millions more into law enforcement. In 1994, President Bill Clinton signed his own law, adding more money for policing and more prison time, again with bipartisan support. Since the crack epidemic, there have been others. There was methamphetamine.
I did meth for the first time. Now, all I do is meth.
Now opioids.
I got some oxy after I hurt my neck. First, I took them to feel better. Then, I just kept taking them.
And with each new drug epidemic, more and more drug users have gotten locked up. Most of them are black and Latino. In 1980, there were around 40,000 people behind bars for drugs. By 2017, there were more than 450,000. Judge Larry Gist watched it all unfold from the bench in Beaumont, Texas, outside Houston. When I went to see him in his chambers in late 2018, he'd been sentencing people for drug crimes for almost 45 years.
I'm noticing all the awards on your...
What?
All the awards on your walls.
Yeah, I got a lot of awards. I have lots of friends in high places.
One of the awards was from Centocor. a shiny plaque shaped like a diamond. I asked him about it.
I got it years ago. I mean, I've been close to them for 20 years, you know, so I guess they just decided to give me a plaque. I mean, you know, I have no idea.
I spent a day in Judge Gist's courtroom. Lawyers watched videos on their phones waiting their turn. One ate a bag of Flamin' Hot Cheetos, even though eating and cell phones were strictly forbidden. And I watched defendant after defendant come before Judge Gist, some wearing shackles.
Mr. Jenkins, the indictment in your case, 30222, alleges that you possessed cocaine. Ms. O'Neill, the indictment in your case alleges that you possessed a methamphetamine. Ms. Cardoza, the indictment in your case alleges you possessed cocaine in a state jail felony amount on November 3rd.
Judge Gist convicted almost everybody in the courtroom that day. Some could have faced 10 years to life for felony possession. Back in his chambers, Gist told us that he opts for probation most of the time, and he tries to send people to treatment in hopes that they can learn to take responsibility for themselves.
The vast majority of folks that I deal with are basically bottom feeders. They've been losers since the day they were born. They had a crackhead mama and a dopehead daddy, or no mama or no daddy. They kicked them out of church. They kicked them out of Little League. They've never achieved anything and don't know how to achieve it. They're basically looking for the perfect welfare state where the do-gooders take care of them.
And over the years, for what he called the hardest core people who've been arrested multiple times and are facing years in prison, Judge Gist would choose CentiCorps.
It's the best thing that I've ever seen for the right people. Last chance people. End of the road. If you don't take advantage of this, you're never going to see sunshine again for the rest of your life.
They would never see sunshine again, because when a judge sends someone to CentiCorps and they don't finish the program, they can be sent to prison for years or for decades. From the very beginning, CentiCorps founder Luke Austin knew how he could grow his program. He wooed judges and law enforcement officials and got them to start sending people to CentiCorps. And when the war on drugs escalated, jails and prisons started overflowing with drug users, and more courts were looking for someplace else to send all those people. CentiCorps fit the bill. It was long-term, and it didn't cost anything. CentiCorps and programs like it became part of a prison-to-rehab pipeline. CentiCorps is supposed to be a pathway out of addiction, but the main treatment method seems to be sending people to work. We asked Judge Gist about that.
Drug treatment can be 1,000 things. Sometimes tough love works better. There's no one way to do it, no right way. It's whatever's right for this person, you know, and who knows what that is. And you gotta try it. Well, let's see what's behind door number 3, you know? Maybe that'll work.
We wanted to go back to Judge Gist to share all the findings of our investigation and get his response. But he passed away a couple months after our interview. We did ask him how many people he'd sent to CentiCorps over the years. He said about 200. Judge Gist was just one of many judges across Texas and Louisiana who have become essential to CentiCorps. Judges have served on CentiCorps' board. Some of them have received their own CentiCorps awards. Some courts have sent just a few people to CentiCorps. Others have sent hundreds. And it all adds up. About half of CentiCorps' residents today are court-ordered. Just talking to people who've attended CentiCorps, it seems like a disproportionate number of them are white. We wanted to know, is there a racial disparity here? How many Black and Latino people arrested on drug charges are even getting the option of CentiCorps instead of prison? But Louisiana and Texas don't track that data. Tim Rowe, who we met earlier in the series, went to CentiCorps voluntarily with help from his sister Penny. When he got to the Baton Rouge facility, he was shocked by how many people were court-ordered into the program.
Most of the people that come in there, they come in there in orange jumpsuits with shackles around their ankles. And, you know, so, they have to be there. So they're just turning those people into just slaves, pretty much.
We've talked to hundreds of people who've been through Centicor's programs. Many of them have been court-ordered.
Bottom line is, I don't want to be a convicted felon.
A friend of mine called the DA and asked him to help me out and, you know, get me rehabilitation instead of a jail sentence.
Look, I had 45 years over my head, so I didn't care if they told me to jump through a flaming hula hoop and, you know, eat a bucket of shit. I was going to eat some shit and jump through some fire.
From its start as a fringe organization in Colorado, Centicor has become an institution with multiple programs in Louisiana and Texas. And the people at Centicor are not making football equipment anymore. So what are they doing? We asked for a tour, but Centicor declined. The only way to find out was to go to Centicor and figure it out for ourselves.
And that's exactly what Sho does. She teams up with our colleague, Laura Starcheski, to find out where Centicor is putting people to work.
There's people taking breaks right there.
They track down Centicor workers in Baton Rouge who are doing all kinds of jobs.
How often do folks from Centicor work here?
I'm not really sure, because everybody wear the same uniform, so, you know, you kind of really can't tell one from another.
Chasing a shadow workforce. That's next time on American Rehab. The American Rehab reporting team is Shoshana Walter, Laura Starcheski, and Ike Srikandarajan. Brett Myers is our editor. Laura is our lead producer and produced this chapter with Catherine Miskowski. Amy Julia Harris helped us report this story from the beginning and launch this project. We had additional editorial support from Narda Zucchino, Andy Donahue, and Esther Kaplan, and production help from WHYY in Philadelphia. Special thanks to Sanduja Rangarajan, Delcia Mercedes, and Spencer Norris. Fact-checking by Rosemary Ho. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Mwende Inahosa. Our production team includes Najib Amini, Amy Mustafa, and Claire Mullen. Our theme song is Lifeline by the dynamic duo Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando My Man Yo Aruda. They composed and performed all of the music on American Rehab. Our CEO is Krista Scharfenberg. Matt Thompson is our editor-in-chief, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Ledson, and remember, there is always more to the story.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal. Odoo, modern management made simple.